Good afternoon, you are tuned to a Juno Afternoon here for Tuesday, the 22nd of March, the year 2016. I'm Jeff Brown, I'll be your host for today. Today, Kevin Crowley from the Juno Convention and Visitors Bureau with Andrew Boger from the Red Cross Elite here to highlight their Marketing Momentum series of panel seminars. We'll talk with Hank Linfer about his presentation at the Valley Library tonight. We'll talk with some of the actors involved from Thunder Mountain High School about their play Shrek. That Writer's Almanac, Murnaut Music and More today on a Juno Afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Tara Gatewood, in for Antonia Gonzalez. The U.S. Supreme Court handed a victory to the Ute Indian tribe of the Uintah and Ouray Reservation Monday. The court declined to hear the appeal of a case that the tribe says hits at the heart of sovereignty. The state of Utah and three counties challenged the tribe's ability to enforce tribal laws. The decision relates to the case of misdemeanor charges stemming from a 2013 traffic stop. Wasatch County maintains the road is no longer reservation land based on previous legal rulings. The 10th Circuit Court of Appeals ruled against the county. While the High Court's rejection of the case is a legal victory for the tribe, it falls short of giving the parties a definitive ruling on the underlying sovereignty issue. Arizona is among the states holding primary elections. Republicans are watching to see whether Donald Trump's opponents can slow his momentum. Trump and his Democratic challengers Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders made campaign appearances in Arizona recently. Joshua LeVar Butler is CEO of Sandstone Public Relations based in Flagstaff, Arizona. He says sovereignty is the key to creating success for tribes.
We really need the support and the protection and the respect for tribal sovereignty. I think that most tribes, in order for them to flourish, in order for them to create enterprises, to create business and revenues for their respective tribes, to expand business, to do business where they need to go.
Butler says he's a Clinton supporter. Polls in Arizona close at 10 p.m. Utah and Idaho are also holding caucuses. The largest tribal government in southeast Alaska now has authority over foster care and other services for Native children facing abuse or neglect. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
An agreement signed this month transfers management as well as funding from the state of Alaska to the Tlingit and Haida Central Council. The organization lists more than 30,000 tribal members. Council President Richard Peterson says Native children have a better chance in life if they know their heritage.
I am ever so grateful that we're taking steps forward, steps that are going to heal those wounds, that are going to put our families back together.
The agreement puts the council in charge of temporary foster care placement until children can safely return home. If that can't happen, it will find permanent homes with relatives or through adoption. Alaska Health and Social Services Commissioner Valerie Davidson says the transfer is long overdue.
This agreement really takes it to a whole new level by extending child welfare and tribal court services, including extensive case management, foster home licensing, financial support for tribal foster homes, and a whole host of other services.
The agreement was modeled after a 2013 compact between the state and Interior Alaska's Tanana Chiefs Conference. For National Native News, I'm Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Tribal health officials can get their questions about the Zika virus answered on a telephone conference call today. The call is hosted by the National Indian Health Board and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The Zika virus is possibly linked to birth defects in newborns. Clusters of microencephalitis are reported in Central and South American countries, as well as Puerto Rico, the U.S. Virgin Islands, and American Samoa, where the mosquito-borne virus is also reported. No U.S. states have reported locally occurring Zika infections, although there have been some travel-related cases. Organizers of the conference call say it's designed for tribal leaders, epidemiologists, and tribal health officials. For National Native News, I'm Tara Gatewood.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. If you or a loved one suffer from alcohol addiction, hear how recovery is possible from those who've had their day one at nativenews.net. Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. You too can become a modern-day warrior. Stand firm with NARF. Learn more at narf.org and join the fight for Native rights. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6 minutes past the hour, and you're tuned to Juno Afternoon here. Listener supported media. In the studio, first two guests, Andrew Bogar and Kevin Crowley, here to talk about Marketing Momentum series of presentations at Juno Convention and Visitors Bureau. Thank you for coming down to the station today.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
And how do you say Juno Convention and Visitors Bureau three times fast?
We say Travel Juno now. It's a lot simpler.
Can you tell me a little bit about the JCVP, please?
Yeah, Travel Juno is also known as Juno Convention Visitors Bureau, is the destination marketing organization for Juno, Alaska. So we promote Juno as a year-round destination for both leisure and business travelers. And we're a membership organization. Our members are local businesses, both directly tourism-related and not. All businesses benefit from the impacts of tourism. And so we try to, magnify that as a economic development driver.
And you've got a series of seminars coming up.
We do. We have a number of events throughout the year that are educationally based, networking based for our members, and we open these events, Marketing Momentum series, to the whole public. So anyone's welcome to come tonight. It's at the Hangar on the Wharf at 5:30, and so we feature different speakers on topics related to marketing, operations, human resources, et cetera, and how businesses can really make the most of and really maximize their impact with, their whatever dollar value that they have in their marketing budget. So tonight is talking about crisis management related to individual businesses, how they can be prepared and proactive.
What are some of the crises that need management?
Well, I will leave that to Andrew from the Red Cross to to go in. That's his area of expertise.
Well, so, there's actually a huge scale of different things to think about when it comes to disasters. Most people think about disasters as earthquakes, floods, hurricanes. Down the lower 48, they're experiencing a lot of floods. We've experienced mudslides here in the southeast. While we've had a mild winter, so wildfires are very high on our radar. That's what people traditionally think as disasters. But if you're a business owner and you have an employee who's experienced a house fire, that may not be a blip on your radar. However, if that employee is the only person that does your accounting or is one of two of your drivers, your business is just taking a serious hit. So promoting personal preparedness amongst your employees and then business preparedness and business continuity. What's going to happen if X happens? Well, then our organization or our business will do Y. Having those plans, being able to communicate those plans amongst your partners in the community and then your employees. And so covering all of those.
Do the plans have to be complicated?
No. Actually, KISS is a really good acronym to remember. Just keep it simple. And the idea is the simpler a plan, the easier it is to remember it. And so the two things to remember is really have a plan so you're not making it up at the last minute, and then communicate that plan both to your employees and your partners.
How do you get started in making a plan?
There's a couple of ways to look at that. You can always call the Red Cross. We have something that helps called the Ready Rating. And it's a self-paced, free, and online resource that if you have a business, if you have a school, you have a church, you own infrastructure, you have employees, you can actually register in this onto our website, and it'll actually walk you through that procedure on how to better prepare yourself for that next event. Also, you can contact CBJ. They have Emergency Management Department. That works very closely with FEMA and the Alaska State Emergency Management Program up in Anchorage. And there are a lot of good resources they have available to them as well. Preparedness information from the state is also online at ready.gov or alaskaready.gov. apologize if I didn't get that just right.
Sometimes to me a crisis is when my computer won't print in my printer.
Well, that's actually a great example. If your business operates around printing or the ability to communicate, any one of the different steps in the process from meeting a customer and giving them an end result or providing a service, if there is a disruption in any of that process, that could constitute a crisis for you, especially if you're no longer making money.
The specification is going on tonight. It was on the panel.
So we have Andrew Bogar here from the Red Cross. We have Tom Matisse from CBJ, as Andrew mentioned as well. And we also have Jennifer Thompson, who is of Thompson & Co. out of Anchorage. It's a PR and communications firm. And so she'll be covering the public relations side of that. Andrew and Tom are, I would say, much more of the kind of logistical aspects of the nuts and bolts of developing those plans. So, those are our panelists.
Is there a cost tonight?
There is. So members, it's $22 and change, and it's $30 for non-members. There's going to be food and drink available, and a great time for networking with other people in the tourism industry, and a really valuable time with these three people, you know, together in one room. Obviously, there are a lot of free resources, which is great, and we want to promote for everyone in the community. But when you can get people together in one room, there is a lot of value to that.
What's the most valuable tool in crisis management?
Andrew, I'm going to defer to you on that one.
Yeah. That's okay. Like I said earlier, it's for me, I believe it's making a plan and then being able to clearly communicate that plan. Once you have a plan, that's great. But if you don't communicate to the people who may have to actually enact that plan, it's not that great. It's an expensive paperweight at that point. Including your employees in that plan as well, it's one thing to talk about your upper-level staff. And if you have a business of even seven individuals, all seven individuals need to know what your disaster plan or your emergency plan is. And that plan needs to be able to cover everything from large natural disasters to even man-made disasters, such as a violent intruder or even a fatality on the work site. So you need to be able to cover all of those, be able to clearly communicate to your employees. And also, and I'm sure tonight they'll cover how to, and this is even out of my realm, is how to clearly communicate that what's going on and have that visibility with your consumers, whomever your customers may be, and the population around you, and be very open about what's going on. But even that, from a business side, even that's out of my hands, which is why it's important you come tonight and find out, because I'd like to hear that too.
I was thinking about when a bear walked into the Alaskan Hotel. They probably didn't have that on their disaster plan.
No, but that's something you probably should think about, especially down here.
Starting at 5:30 tonight?
Yeah, starts at 5:30. Doors open. Yeah, and 6:30, the program officially will begin as far as the panelists.
How many members are there in GCDB?
We have 253 members as of today. So, but there's a heck of a lot more than 253 businesses in Juneau. So, we provide a lot of great value through our marketing benefits. And if anyone out there is interested in learning more and becoming a member, they can email me at members@traveljuneau.com. I'd be happy to talk more.
What are some of the other panels you've got coming up in the future?
Let's see. Well, we have our travel fair, as far as events, is that what you mean? Yeah. Our travel fair is a big open public event that is April 16th, the Saturday after Folkfest, and it's at the Jack this year. We're going to have music from KXLL. We're going to have a beer garden from the Alaskan Brewery, food trucks from some of our local food vendors, and, of course, our members who are, you know, tours and attractions and accommodations and offering all sorts of, you know, discounts and even raffling off some free tours and attractions. So it's a great opportunity to get down and find out what there is to do, you know, through your visiting friends and family and yourself during the summer and during the winter as well. And then in May, we have someone from TripAdvisor that's going to be talking about reputation management as it pertains to TripAdvisor, which is it's a hot topic. Yeah. So that's something to look forward to in May, on May 12th.
And if people need to call you or get a hold of you, what's the best way to do that?
Yeah, they can email me as members at traveljuno.com, or they can call our office, which is 586-2201 is our main line.
Or they can go to the crisis management lecture tonight.
And they can come tonight and find out more, absolutely. Yeah.
All right, Andrew Bogart and Kevin Colley, thank you so much for coming by. Is there anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
You've covered it all. Thanks so much, Jeff.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 22nd of March, 2016. It's the birthday of the novelist who wrote these sentences. I just pointed my rifle at him and let him have the big one right through the third button on his shirt. If he ever figured to sew that particular button on again, he was going to have to scrape it off his backbone. Louis L'Amour, the author of many Western novels, born in Jamestown, North Dakota, 1908. It's the birthday of Stephen Sondheim, New York City, 1930. When he was 27, he was offered a job writing lyrics for a new musical, a modern retelling of Romeo and Juliet set in New York City. The result was West Side Story, came out on Broadway in 1957, got mixed reviews, but it was a huge hit as a movie. It's the birthday of the poet Billy Collins, born in New York City, 1941, an only child. Before he knew how to read, he would sit and page through books and pretend that he was reading whenever his parents had company. Wrote his first poem at the age of 7 when he saw a sailboat on the East River. Billy Collins said, I was a most impressionable teenager back in the days of beatnik glory, so I responded fully to Kerouac, Ginsberg, Ferlinghetti's Coney Island of the Mind, Gregory Corso, and others. I was a Catholic high school boy in the suburbs who fantasized about stealing a car and driving nonstop to Denver. I probably would have done it, but I didn't have access to those special driving pills that Neil Cassidy had. Plus, there was always a test to study for, or band practice. Billy Collins' most recent book, Aimless Love. And it's the anniversary of the first private screening of a motion picture. Paris, 1895, Auguste and Louis Lumière. They made a movie of a group of workers leaving a factory in Lyon. It was only 46 seconds long, but it was very popular. People wanted to see it, but the Lumières felt that motion pictures were just a fad and there was no future in it. Here's a poem by David Solner, A Dog by the Sea. Just after dawn, we get up without coffee and let the dog lead us through a grove of wind-stunted trees, spiked succulents, red-berried holly, and over the dune ridge out of the gray of still-sleeping mines. A line of pink from the not-yet-risen sun reminds me of the lilac shadows caught in the radial grooves of shells. I take up your hand and feel the blood warming your fingers as the dog bounds off, dragging her leash through wet sand. She's after gulls and a line of waves that repeat themselves, she seems to think, because they want to play. A morning breeze stirs the now turning tide, breathing over it, sighing toward Bayside. As the waves come in, whorls of light unfold on the sand. How I want for us to repeat ourselves, on and on, you holding the leash of a silly dog, me feeling the beat, the blood in your hand. A poem by David Selner, A Dog by the Sea, from his collection Blue Morning Light, published by Pond Road Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Progressive Insurance, working to make progress for more than 75 years. And by Staples, offering printer ink and toner cartridges for home and business, with in-store print shops, offering customized presentations, booklets, and manuals. in-store and online staples make more happen. Produced by Joy Biles, with Teresa Burgess, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's 20 minutes past the hour, and you're tuned to Juno Afternoon. Our next guests are here to talk about Science on a Screen, going on at the Downtown Library tonight. Beth Weigel and Hank Lenfer, thank you for coming down to the station today.
Thanks, Jeff.
So, Science on a Screen sounds formidable.
Well, it's actually a grant that the Juno Public Libraries and the Gold Town Nickelodeon and the Friends of the Juno Public Libraries applied for and received from the Coolidge Corner Foundation and the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. And the idea of Science on Screen is that you pair well-known or sort of cult classics, documentaries, films, with a speaker who can speak to the science of what maybe is happening in the film a little bit. So our film for tonight is The Birder's Guide to Everything, and it's actually one of the films that the Sloan Foundation lists in their catalog and helped to workshop a little bit, I think, and won a couple of awards. And it's kind of a quirky little film about a teenage birding fanatic, and he thinks he's spotted a now possibly bird that's gone extinct. And so he's very excited about that, and he gathers up his buddies, and they go on an epic journey. And while a lot of what happens in the film really speaks to the relationships of young people and teenagers and the things that they're going through, like maybe the divorce of parents and things like that, there's some really, I think, good birding parts to it. And so that's our film. And we paired that with Hank Lenfer, who, of course, is over from Gustavus to talk a little bit about recording the sounds of nature. He has been involved in a project with Richard Nelson, which he's going to tell us about, recording the sounds of Glacier Bay. And so we thought that was a really great pairing. And so we invited him over, and he very graciously accepted. So welcome to Juno, Hank.
Yeah, great. It's good to be here.
So what are you going to be explaining tonight?
I'll be talking about the work Richard and I have been doing recording. I'll have my equipment at the library tonight. I'll have my computer and the software that we use to catalog and analyze sounds. And I'll be talking about just how fun it is to go out and listen really closely. And I have watched this film in advance of today's events, and I could really identify with the kids in this film. And they're geeks. They're obsessed with birds, and I could really see myself in them. And the only kind of bigger nature geek that I've ever met is Richard Nelson. And he's a guy who takes it right out of geekdom into this really fun and cool way of interacting, not just with the natural world, but with other people that share your passion. So I'll try and touch on all those things tonight. But centered in tonight's presentation will be the sounds from our world. And those of us here in Southeast Alaska are really fortunate to live in such a sound-rich place, and you don't have to go that far out of downtown Juneau to be in a really quiet place. And with this early spring, the juncos already singing. I've heard the first varied thrush, the first hooters already going. And so there's just lots to get out and pay attention to.
What happens? Do you hear a bird and you run? Do you find your recording gear and then sit out?
Sometimes I do and sometimes I don't. Like the juncos are the first ones to start up, and I've got a lot of recordings of juncos, so I don't tend to run for my parabolic. But there are a number of birds that I will run and get. Like in Gustavus, I live alongside a little stream that has dippers in there, and the dippers sing, but you're never sure when they're going to do it. But they sing on and off all winter, and I'll probably spend the rest of my life trying to get the single best dipper recording. So I always run for my parabolic dish when I hear those guys go off. And another bird that just recently sent me running for my dish was a northern shrike, which is another bird that you're never sure when they're going to sing, but it's such an amazing sound. And I've only got a couple recordings, but I've yet to get a really good one.
Not to be confused with Shrek.
That's right.
Do you think that there are going to be sounds in our natural world that are going to be disappearing, that, you know, that we need to preserve these sounds?
Yeah, certainly. Imagine if Lewis and Clark had been outfitted with a digital recorder along with their muskets. And they had been able to preserve the sounds that they heard when they were traveling across this continent not that long ago. And what a treasure that would be to be able to go back and listen to the continent at that point in time. And so things do change at an astounding rate. And that's part of the reason Richard and I have been funded to go out and build a library of sound that coming to Alaska and recording is as close as we can now get to putting a recorder back in the hands of somebody like Lewis and Clark. And we don't know what sounds are still going to be in place 100 years from now in Alaska.
And I was thinking, too, when you're talking about that, just the idea that, you know, the soundscape changes over a period of time, and that, you know, what naturalists maybe used to use as their notebook, is this becoming sort of your new notebook in some ways, you know, and able to, you know, kind of make your notes about the natural world with the recorder, or do you still rely on observations and notebooks, drawings and things like that as well?
The whole art of recording is kind of where digital photography was maybe, I don't know, 10 years ago. When it was just coming online, and the digital recorders are, there's just more and more of them out there, so more and more people are taking use of them. Pretty much everybody's got a recorder in their back pocket right now in the form of an iPhone, and you can do fine recordings with those things. And so, yeah, it's becoming a really common and popular tool for both documenting and learning about our world. And one of the things I'll share with people tonight is iBird, which is a fantastic app, which is in my back pocket when I'm out in the wilds, because you can use your phone, grab a bird sound you don't know what it is, go through this iBird app, which has all the bird songs, and you can toggle back and forth, listen to the bird you've just recorded, listen to this catalog of recorded sounds to help you identify a bird that you've never even seen. Just through its voice.
And what's going to happen with the catalog of sounds that you've been recording with Richard? Where do they go? Where do they live after this project?
They live in a couple different places. Our contract was through the National Park Service at Glacier Bay, so there's a copy of the whole database we've put together resides at Bartlett Cove. And the project was also in partnership with Cornell University, which has the biggest catalog of natural sounds in the world. So they've got a copy. And all of the sounds we've recorded, along with their other 300,000 plus sounds, whatever it is now, are all available online. So you could go and search their online library, type in Glacier Bay, and all of our sounds will be there.
It's interesting, because in the early days of recording, you had to deal with tape hiss.
Right.
And now it's all digital, and if you have a good microphone, that is the key.
That's right. That's right. And so you can, you don't have to spend a lot of money to get into digital recording, but as you spend more money, you get cleaner and cleaner sounds, and that hiss, that background noise gets lower and lower.
And what time is your presentation tonight?
Tonight, it starts at 5:30 at the downtown library.
So we've sandwiched his talk tonight in between the two free screenings for the movie over at the Gold Town. So you can either rush right out the door right now and head to the Gold Town and catch the film at 3:30 and then come over to the library at 5:30 for the talk. Or you can come to the library first and we'll have a few snacks and refreshments if you're worried about not having enough time for dinner. So we'll have a few things for you to eat, and you can listen to Hank's talk at 5:30 and then head to the Gold Town at 7. And if you can't make it tonight, or you can't see the film tonight and you can make the talk, we are going to reshow the film for free again out at the Valley Library on Friday. And we're also having our Science Friday program at the Valley Library from 1 to 3. We're focused on birds as well. The Raptor Center is going to bring some of their favorite friends. We'll have some cool skulls and talons and wings and things like that from Fish and Game. And my friend Amy Nye and Naturalist is going to come out and help talk a little bit more about birds and what you can learn from birds. And it'll be a great time. And then you can watch the film at 3:30 at the Valley on Friday.
I'm assuming this is one of a series
of our Science Fridays. We do Science Fridays usually when school is out, and this week is spring break, so school is out, so we thought we'd do one. And then we'll do some Science Fridays in July in the summer as well at the library. So, yeah.
All right, Hank Linford and Beth Weigel, thank you for coming down. Is there anything I've forgotten to add?
No, I think that covers it. Thanks for having us, Jeff.
This is Bird Note. These distinctive hoots signal the presence of a sumo wrestler of a bird. It's Blakiston's fish owl. Blakiston, because its existence was recorded by the English naturalist Thomas Blakiston. And fish owl, because it hunts fish. Standing on the edge of a stream, sometimes in the shallows, it watches intently, eyes fixed on the water. Then with a sudden jump forward, wings upraised, it plunges its talons into a fish and pulls it onto the bank. Sometimes, a fish as large as a salmon. This massive bird is the largest owl in the world. Tawny brown, a female Blakiston's fish owl, is the larger of the sexes and may stand 28 inches tall, weighing in at over 10 pounds. That's the same weight as a bald eagle. Compared with our largest familiar owl, the great horned, the Blakiston's is 6 inches taller and nearly 3 times as heavy. No other owl approaches its prodigious girth. But the Blakiston's fish owl is endangered. It's found only in wooded areas in the east of Japan's second largest island, Hokkaido, and in small areas in adjacent Russia and China. Future preservation of forest and river habitats in these regions will be crucial to the survival of this one-of-a-kind owl.
It's 33 minutes past the hour, and you're tuned to a Juno Afternoon. Our next guest in the studio is Megan Garrison from the Juno Arts and Humanities Council, here to talk about a tote bag that we're working on. Thanks for coming down, Megan.
You're welcome, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
So, what do you mean by a tote bag?
So, Foodland IGA came to us a couple weeks ago with a great idea, and it was to have a reusable tote bag, the ones we all love to carry around, canvas, so that we're not using too much paper and plastic, but put a great Juno design on the front. And every year we'll come out with a new tote bag design. So, right now we are taking applications from artists who are interested for the design on the front.
How big is the design?
The tote bag itself will be 14 inches by 17 inches, so it will have to fit within that size parameter.
And what kind of medium can be reproduced effectively on the tote bag?
Any type of graphic. It can be full color, so it could be a scanned painting, but note that an outline will have to be cut out of it at some point. I don't know if it could take over that whole 14 by 17 face. And, of course, artists can work with me on details for that and the printing company as well. But they'll need to submit designs as PDFs to the JAC. And there's a call for art on our website that describes everything. And if you can get it in an Adobe Illustrator file as well. That's very helpful. But if you have trouble with that, we can talk about it.
What's the process going to be for transferring the image onto the bag?
That process won't happen here in Juneau. That will happen through the printing company that Foodland has chosen to make these bags. And so the first printing will be 5,000 bags, and the artist will get a cut of the profit per bag.
That's a good deal.
Sold. Yeah. So it's a great deal. So we are working hard on paying artists for their art, and this is a great community step towards that, I think.
You're not going to charge me for coming down here, are you?
No.
All right, so people need more information, that's the best way to get it.
Online at the Jack, I've got everything written up under our resources tab on our website, if you go and look for the call for art there. The due date is next Friday. It's a little bit scrunched in there because we're trying to get them printed so that we can have a good portion of them ready for when the tourist season hits. And this will be an ongoing call. We can print more through the year, and we'll do the same thing again next year, but we'll choose a different artist, similar to Folkfest.
Cool. Megan Garrison, thank you for coming by.
Thank you.
Mr. Fancy Pants, I can see you're ready to take all the willing girls back home to their place. Well, you play in a band, you need a place to crash. Oh, who will be the lucky ones who gets to take Mr. Fancy Pants home? Fancy Pants, Mr. Fancy Pants, lucky girl, sweet romance, Fancy Pants, Fancy Pants. Oh, who will be the lucky one? Mr. Fancy Pants, well, you spent all your dough on a three-piece suit down at the vintage store. Well, it's just right, you'll be courting girls tonight. No flares, no need for chivalry. Don't mess with Fancy Pants, you see. Fancy Pants, Mr. Fancy Pants, lucky girl, sweet romance. Fancy pants, oh, who will be the lucky one? Ah, 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 ah. Mr. Fancy Pants, you're playing your guitar, you got your hair slicked back, you're looking dandy. Yeah, who's that stud in the style and dust? It's Fancy Pants and he's your man. He can stand in the mirror like no one can. Fancy Pants, Mr. Fancy Pants, lucky girl, sweet romance, Fancy Pants.
That's the Carper family. They're guest artists at the annual Folk Festival coming up. They'll be performing on Thursday night and on Sunday night. And it starts on the 4th of April and goes until the 10th. And the studio with me now is Connor Lundrum from Mishkanedi. And they're having a poetry slam on Friday at the University of Alaska Southeast.
That's right. It's a part of UAS's Sound in Motion series. They've been doing like videos and talks and things like that. And every year around this time, we schedule our poetry slam to be a part of the series because we love what UAS does with their Sound in Motion, and we like being part of the artistic community as a whole. And we actually have a theme this month, and that's going to be thawed. So if anyone out there feels like coming to compete in our poetry slam, bring 3 original pieces, no props, no musical accompaniment, and come give a shot at competing at our poetry slam. It's a great time. You get a $25 cash prize if you win, and a chance to compete at our grand slam in October.
Cool.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I love it. I love our poetry slams. They're great. I'll be emceeing the event along with a student that is so far unannounced, and it's going to be really cool. I love going out to UAS because we do a lot of our events downtown, so it's nice to be able to go out into the valley, and for people who might have a hard time getting farther down south, have a chance to come see us.
How many different types of poetry slams are there?
Different types of poetry slams? Well, I'm mostly just aware of, like, two different kind of types, and that's sort of, like, the kinds that are part of the main competitive circuit on a national level where people, like, practice and write their poetry and are really intense about it, and the whole point is the competition so that there's someone who is the winner, who is the best at some level, and it, like, can get really big and intense, and it focuses on the competition. And then there's slams like our slams, where we have a saying, and it's not about the points, it's about the poetry. The judges are always picked out of the audience, and it's just for that one night, and we really are focused more on fostering a community and an environment where people are safe and happy and excited to express themselves artistically, and it's not about the competition so much. So ours is much more art-focused. So I guess in my mind, there are two kinds of slams. There are those that focus on the competition, and there are those that focus on the art, and we are definitely the art-focused.
You mentioned no musical instruments. Have you ever done a slam which is supposed to include musical instruments?
We don't do slams, but we've changed our format. So 1 month we'll do a open mic, the next month we'll do a slam, and then the month after that we'll do a poetry workshop. And so at the open mics, you can do poems with musical accompaniment. You can either bring your own music, or we have a house band, Jacob Picard. He plays wonderful music, and he'll improv along with you in the open mic, which we'll do in 2 months from now. And those kinds of events, like, we encourage all sorts of expression and stuff like that. But when it comes to the poetry itself, like for the slam, we try to focus on just the one person's performative ability with their poetry.
And how long does a typical slam last?
I would say since we changed our format, and it used to be like a three-hour event. Now I'd say it's probably more like 90 minutes.
And it's happening at the University of Alaska Southeast.
University of Alaska Southeast. Sign-up is at 5:30. The competition kicks off at 6, so it's a little bit earlier than our usual schedule because we changed a little bit to fit with the Sound in Motion series. So, yeah, it's first come, first serve. We take 12 sign-up, I think, is the highest that we'll do, or 10, maybe. I'm not sure, but there should be plenty of room for everyone, and we're pretty used to bending the rules to get as many people to read as possible. So if you have poetry that you want to come read and you want to come compete with, you should definitely come check it out.
In your experience in poetry slams here in Juneau, is there an age range that seems to gravitate more towards poetry slams?
You know, there's a very consistently wide, like, birth. Like, I think that at least half the slams that will have people who are, you know, under 15, like, at least one person will come up and, like, you know, read something, even if it's only one person who's under 15. And then we have people who are, like, in their 60s and even in their 70s occasionally. But I would say probably the main age group is between 18 and 35. So even in that's a pretty big spread. But I would say that's about the main age group.
Cool.
Yeah, so everyone should feel welcome to come. Like, it doesn't matter what your age is. It doesn't matter how much experience you have. There's no prereqs for coming. And you should just, if you have art that you want to come express through poetry in a community and, you know, meet some other like-minded people and, like, meet the people who are involved in Woosh, the board of directors will be there, other regulars will be there, and you'll be able to tap into that. And maybe you can come next month to our poetry workshop. We'll do a creative writing workshop next month at Kindred Post.
It seems to me like a very supportive organization.
Absolutely. Inclusiveness is our watchword, you could say. We make sure to, like, have all of our events in, like, public venues that are easily accessible, that are dry events, so that anyone who's, like, in recovery or might have substance or alcohol issues will feel free to come and be there. And we have it in place also because then, like, you know, people who aren't 21 can come as well. We want it to be a place where people feel as safe and comfortable and welcome as possible.
Over the years, has there been a theme that develops? Like, there's more songs, more poems about love, more poems about activity, the forest and the natural world that surrounds us.
You know, I've only been on the board for 2 years, and sometimes we'll do a theme that we'll pick out ahead of time, and sometimes people do it, and sometimes they don't. Because we do have a theme this month, it's Thawed, but we won't turn you away if you don't have pieces that adhere to that. Like, for example, I know that my friend Ryan's going to come, and he's going to perform, and none of his work has to do with the theme, because he wrote it a while ago, and he's been waiting for the next slam to do it. No, I don't think there is any one theme that has really stuck out. Not in my mind. It's great. Like, it's more like you can see certain performers who will come back again and again. Because that's one of the best things is, like, you know, we're very consistent. We're there every month in some form or another. And so we'll get performers who come back, and I can see themes with them. And I can learn things from their life and their experiences and the way that they express their poetry, just in the same way, like, any poet you'll be familiar with. Like, you know, if you read a bunch of Keats, you can be like, oh, he writes a lot about death and love and the impermanency of existence and the terrifying aspects of decay and things like that. And the same is true for people performing at poetry slams. You don't really see a theme in the community, but you do see a theme in the person.
What are some of your favorite poets? Not the ones here in Juneau, but...
No, in general, right. Man, some of my favorite poets. Well, I do actually have to say that two of my favorite poets do live here in town. That would be DJ Derego and Christy Nami Erickson. Those two are some of my absolute favorite poets, and they are on the board of directors for Woosh. I also really like Keats. I like John Donne a lot.
What about their work, strikes you?
For John Donne, it's his ability to... have really interesting metaphors that sort of sneak up on you, like writing about a tick or something like that. And like he's writing it like to, in this poem, the speaker of the poem is speaking to a woman. He's talking about a tick or he's talking about an insect or something like that. And then you slowly realize that as you're reading it, he's actually seducing this woman by talking about an insect. This very direct but extremely effective thing. And he's just so clever in his ability to surprise you with what the true content of his work will be. And it just incredibly impresses me every time, because even though it is indirect, it surprises you, it is incredibly honest and very forthright. And even though, like, he'll be working through all these conceits, by the end of the poem, you feel like you know exactly what he's talking about and exactly who he is, and it's clear as day.
I'm wondering if over the years you've collected these in written form to share with others in a book form.
Me?
Or the organization, Woosh is.
Oh, Woosh has done a couple of chapbooks. We try to do a chapbook every year. I think that there wasn't a lot of interest from the community, but I think that we're going to keep doing it where we collect poems from people who show up at the slams, a lot like that. So all local poets or people who like have come to the competitions, and we'll ask them to contribute, and then we'll print them up and we'll have them for sale at the slams usually. And it's a small little chat book with, you know, 20 to 30 poems all done by locals. And it's just a nice collection of local written art. And so we do have some little collections for sale. I can't remember the price off the top of my head right now. But if you come to the slam or to any of our events, we've got shirts for sale. We've got chapbooks. We've got CDs. Yeah, it's a good deal.
Hannah Lundgren, thank you for coming down.
Jeff, thank you so much for having me on.
My mind outside in the night, outside of the
about 8 minutes past the hour, and you're before the hour, you're tuned to Juno Afternoon. In the studio with you next are Rebecca and Remington, students from Thunder Mountain High School, here to talk about Shrek. Thanks for coming down.
Thank you.
So for people who don't know what Shrek is, can you tell me the plot and the basics?
Well, basically, Shrek is a love story between an ogre and a princess, with a little bit of drama in between. But this story differs from the original movie. It's written a little bit differently and focuses more on Farquaad and fairy tale creatures, and really promotes diversity and fairness, and how being accepted is very important, and it's less so a love story between two.
Yeah, it's really a story about acceptance and diversity and what it means to be different and being okay with being different. Yeah.
I can just imagine how much fun the costumes must be to wear.
Oh my yeah. Gosh, there's so much fun. I'm playing Fiona, Princess Fiona, and I got to try my costume on earlier this week, just I think Saturday, I think? Yeah, Saturday I got to try my costume on for the first time, and it's so nice. There's so much fun. The costumes are a lot, because we have a lot of fairy tale characters that are wearing really interesting costumes. You know, we have like Pinocchio and a whole bunch of really crazy fairy tale costumes. They're so much fun.
And it's a musical.
Yes, it is.
What percentage of the play is musical related?
I'd say every two or three scenes there's a song, and play is two acts, so.
I would say maybe like it's 50%, 50 to 60% yeah. Song probably.
Yeah.
There's quite a lot of music in it.
How many people are in the play?
About 25, just about, high schoolers. Yeah.
Can you give me an idea of the plot?
Yeah, so the plot, I mean, it basically, it follows, so Shrek, all these fairy tale creatures get put onto Shrek's swamp where he lives, and Shrek is super grouchy, so he's not interested in that at all. So Shrek goes to talk to Lord Farquaad, who put all the fairy tale creatures on the swamp, and Farquaad says, like, look, I'll give you your swamp back if you go and rescue this princess for me. So Shrek goes and rescues the princess, and the rest of the story follows them going back to Lord Farquaad's castle, and that's where, you know, a lot of, I mean, that's where, like, the love story comes in. There's, like, a love story between Shrek and Fiona. It just follows Shrek on his quest to rescue Fiona and get his swamp back.
And Remington, what do you play?
I play Shrek.
That must be a kick in the pants to play.
Yeah, it's certainly been a lot of fun, but it's had its challenges.
Like what?
Well, for one, the accent was really hard to get down, but it's been coming along.
Give us a sample now, please.
get out of my swamp! And I don't really know much the lines.
Oh, gosh,
but,
I can't.
I take it back, I know all of the lines. But can't think of any on the spot. But yeah, so he's been a lot of fun. Singing's been kind of weird because they want me to try and sing in character, and singing is very hard to do, much less in the voice of someone else. So it's been very challenging, but I've had a blast doing it.
When does it open?
March 31st?
Yes, March 31st. Next Thursday, I believe, is when we open. And we have shows all next weekend and the following weekend. At 7 o'clock Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and 2 o'clock matinees each Saturday. So,
what's the most fun thing about playing in the play?
Oh, gosh. I get this question, like, all the time, and it's so difficult because I just enjoy everything. I think my favorite part has to be I really enjoy hanging out with the other people in the cast. You know, the people who put on plays are always a lot of fun to be around. So I just really enjoy going to rehearsal and getting to, like, you know, literally, like, play and, like, have this fun interaction with a whole bunch of my friends. That's probably my favorite part.
Does it go for just one weekend, or is it 2 weekends?
Two weekends. We open on the 31st, and we have shows the 31st, the 1st, and the 2nd, and then we also have shows on the 7th, 8th, and 9th.
And it's happening at the high school auditorium there?
Yes, it's happening at the high school auditorium. Tickets are $10 for students, $15 for adults, and they're also $10 for seniors. And you can get them at the door from cast members, online through the Jack, or at Hearthside.
All right, Remington and Rebecca, thank you for coming down. Is there anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
I think I'm good.
I don't think so. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
of Tomorrow on a June Afternoon, Jimmy Waste will be your host. We'll talk with Scott Burton about this Friday's presentation, highlighting the work of Ernestine Hayes. We'll get the details about this Saturday's Zach Gordon Easter Egg Hunt. We'll also talk with Annalie Hershey about this summer Arts and Science Festival in Sitka. And we'll talk with Andrew Heist about the screening of the film The Vatican Museums, the last in the Great Museums of the World series. That Burn Note Music More tomorrow at 3 on a June afternoon. Repeated at 4 on KRNN and online by demand. Well, the forecast for tonight, mostly cloudy skies with isolated rain showers in the evening. Wednesday, rain likely with high temperatures around 43 degrees. Wednesday night, mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain. Low temperatures around 35 degrees. Thursday, looks like partly cloudy skies with high temperatures around 49 degrees. Friday, mostly cloudy skies. It looks like rain is predicted for Friday night and the weekend. Tonight at 7 here on KTUO News, live election coverage from National Public Radio.
This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in Dallas.